This project, which has been running since the end of June, is something which has rather alarmed me this summer. I was absolutely determined to have absolutely nothing to do with the 1914-18 anniversary. And then, first of all, Paul Morehouse at the National Portrait Gallery, and then Dover Museum and a group called DMAG, which is a group of art galleries and museums in the Dover area, kind of paid to that. And the brief I was given, and I think when you asked to make a project, it's interesting to see how much flexibility you get given, was that could I produce something by the new year which might be interesting? And could I spend the summer and the autumn doing it? Which actually, when you're given that much of an open page, it's a little alarming. The central core of it, however, was always going to be to do with the notion of this extraordinary town and its place within Kent, and how that, during the First World War, kind of serves as a way of reflecting on who we are. I don't want to say any more than that now, except to say that all I knew was that I had to spend some time working in a way I wouldn't normally do, which was to go backwards and forwards from the town. So, I came up with the title Channel Firing, which of course is drawn from a poem which Thomas Hardy wrote in the April before the war broke out. That night, your great guns unawares shook all our coffins as we lay. And it's about fire practice in the channel he's hearing it, actually in the West Country, of course. Hardy is one of those poets who, like a number of musicians, whose response to the conflict, you could almost say, was silence. He'd written a great deal about the war, a war, at the beginning of the 20th century, particularly his responses to the 1899 plus Boer conflict. Actually, a lot of the writing he did then prefigures some of Wilfred Owen's writing. Wilfred Owen's Strange Meeting, I Am the Enemy You Killed, is partially modelled on a Thomas Hardy poem from that period. But Hardy himself is kind of interesting because he's problematic figure, because he speaks to some an ideal of England which maybe never existed, but it was an ideal which would then start to emerge to get a lot of traction as the war progressed. That's not really the centre of what I'm doing, so I'm just going to talk my way into it and talk about process. For once I was given the opportunity to have quite a light touch musically, so my wife and I decided that what we would do is we would first of all walk the Pilgrim's Way all the way from Winchester to Dover. We did that in 6 hops, so that's about 6. That's 30 miles a day, basically. And then we walked the whole Kent coast after we did that. So basically, and then we started crisscrossing. So in the past 2 months, it's probably done about 350 miles of walking towards this. Walking is very important to my work anyway, and gradually, some of you will know, my work as a graphic artist has been finding its way towards the front of process. So what's coming from this is a level of things. There's writing, of course. There is found music, and there's going to be some music later today. Roger Chaddock's going to come in at about 1:15, and we're going to play some bits of music which I date from the war or have an uncomfortable relationship with it. And for me, I'm also going to play the one Elgar piece, which for me fits with Channel Firing, which is his Sospiri in the original Violent Gamma version, which dates from exactly the same time. So we started walking, we started gathering stuff. These two things are from either ends of the process. The one on the left, it was actually taken just a few miles east of Farnham last week. I decided to walk that end of it again. And I always had one of the texts which has found its way into my work is a text which Hermann Hesse wrote not long after the war, when totally traumatised by it. He'd been a soldier and written some very interesting journalism during the war, which was collected later in a book called If the War Goes On. But after the war, he walked himself south into Italy. And One of the lines, he wrote this book of poems and very, very almost medievally simple descriptions of this experience of walking south and leaving Germany. One of the things he wrote was, our meadows are surrounded by barbed wire, and he noted by the end of the First World War, he noticed for the first time the correlation between these two things. And over, in between having walked that path, the one on the left in July and now, new barbed wire got up on that tree. And it was rather horrifying. This is the other end of the wall. This is coming towards Shakespeare Cliff, coming in from Folkestone. These are First World War replacements here, and that's the white cliff just here and there. So I'm just going to walk into it. What started to fascinate me was something which I'm probably neurotically obsessed with, but I don't think it's possible for any musician not to be, and that's the notion of typology. We as musicians play with typology all the time. Every time you play a piece of Beethoven and you think about its relationship to Bach, or you play a piece of Beethoven and you think about its relationship to Brahms, that's an act of typology, the same way as relating Christ's time in the wilderness to the 40 days of the flood, which is, of course, is the, if you like, the correct use of the word. So this kind of idea of a cinching action of 1418, a place where things get concentrated, and speaking to what happened before and afterwards, both time and also to do with landscape, meant that other writers started to appear. The bit of text there is the description of Shakespeare Cliff from King Lear, where Lear implies that he's going to go and commit suicide by weeping bride, which he doesn't do. This was something which we ran into an immediately pre-war little mark. Does anyone recognise that? Anyone spent any time near Reigate? If you go on the downs of a Reigate...
Is that chapel? Was it the chapel for...
No, I haven't been inside it.
1904. Yes. This was put up in 1911, just on the downs, as a gift to Reigate from a kind of local worthy. And it was a water fountain on top of the downs. It's no longer a water fountain. It's also a map sighting point with this amazing, beautiful mosaic universe in it. And that was one of the things we felt. If you walk west from Merston, you'll get to that.
I saw that as a ceiling.
It is a ceiling.
It's a
covered fountain.
Okay, all right.
It is, yeah. So these things we started to kind of gather. And, of course, some of the things which started to emerge were some of the symbols which we associate with the conflict. If you're English, for instance, there's the question of the poppy, which is one of the most vexed things imaginable. I live 5 minutes walk from Tower Hill. So I've been getting angrier and angrier and angrier and angrier and angrier as that pool of blood has gathered itself around the Tower of London. I'd like to remind you that the only thing that happened in the Tower of London in the First World War was we shot 17 German spies there. So watching that, what was a very subtle piece of art as it emerged at the beginning, the few poppies emerging, turn into this, actually quite horrific thing, is very disturbing if you know anything about the history. And the poppy, of course, in particular its relationship to the English intelligentsia who were writing the poetry about it in the 19th century, is far more complex than it's become seen now. So, but that's walking down towards Lenin at one point. There was a question, how do you document a walk? Especially if you're a musician, you want to find shapes and things and you're talking to composers. And along with the drawings, these things started to emerge, which were basically gradient maps of the walk in cross section, which I do each time we did one, with stuff we found along the way, birds or plants or historical objects. It's a rather Victorian way of doing things, but I really loved it. And it's quite wonderful when you see a cross section of where you've walked. And also, these have also started to find their ways into as pieces of music as well, because put bluntly, that can work as a graphic score. So this is still in the question of how do you find your way towards the project. There is the other thing that happens, of course, which is that I'm very interested in the notion of, I'll come back to in a minute, of pilgrimages. And when I was in my late teens, I read a series of books by a man called Oliver Stadler, who some of you may have read, who was an American GI who stayed in Japan after the Second World War. And he wrote one particular book called Japanese Pilgrimage, which is an amazing book, which is specifically looking at the what happens to our European approach to pilgrimage when you accept the fact that a Japanese pilgrimage is often secular and nobody minds whether how little or how much you do of it. Whereas, you know, for instance, we all, when if you're in English and you study your Chaucer at school, we all laughed about the fact that the Chaucer pilgrim started at St. James's Garlic Hive just on Thames Street there, walked over London Bridge and then had a rest. And they only made it to Canterbury. It was the cut price pilgrimage, and they were doing it in the shortest possible stages they could, going to as many hostelries on the way. But one of the things, of course, that happens when you try and walk, in a straight line anyway, any direction, even on the North Downs Way, which is one of the world's most ancient roads, I'll get to the kind of geological side of that, you constantly find yourself either going off the path because someone closes parts of it, or because you're going back to a train station. So you end up with these forking different... anyone who walks will recognise this. How do you... When I took that photograph of my wife and son over there, I was very upset because in order to get to the train station, we had to turn back on ourselves 25 degrees and walk 4 miles in the wrong direction, which is very upsetting. You know.
One of the things is if you walk along North Downs Way, you can't find anywhere to stay. I did it, and I walked one day, sleeped rough, walked another day, and then went back on the train.
You can't do it.
You spend more time walking, looking for a place to stay than you have to do on the path.
Exactly. So this was a process which I began earlier,
which was another way of looking at the period of time. This is what happens if you map the First World War in terms of Chamberlainism. So this is 1913 through to 1919 there. So some shocking things all the way through over here, the Prokofiev ballad for cello and piano, his first piece of chain music. The blue circles, the composers getting killed. Above Maignard, Rudy Stefan, Septimus Kelly, Lee Boulanger dying, Debussy dying, and down there, Boulnois, a French composer. That's deaths of composers, which are not to be seen as being any more tragic than the deaths of anybody else. And then, kind of crucial works, the real, the big war pieces, the John Ireland Second Violin Sonata, which was, in fact, the first piece of chamber music where it was recognised in the UK that this was a piece of war music which was more than just being genius, and that there was something doubting going on there. Here is a piece that Septimus Kelly wrote at Gallipoli just before he was killed, his elegy for Rupert Brooke. Septimus Kelly was amazing, he was an Australian composer, Olympic oarsman. And constantly then, of course, you run across these people who they're less common now, who are engaged in multiple disciplines. And I've got kind of very enamoured of these characters. But first of all, of course, anybody from Europe has grown up with the sheer offensiveness of this conflict in their faces. And there's nowhere better to illustrate it than this. This is the sound of... Well, basically, this is the sound of death for so many in the trenches. Which is one of the most terrifying noises imagined, made by the Hudson Whistle Company, who manufactured policemen's whistles and football whistles until the war. And then they came up with this. And of course, the reason it works so well is a musical one, which is you have these two chords, two notes, and it makes a beat. And so it carries horribly, it's terrifying. And the effect, it arrives in the person, and it lures a little more low again. And so, from a musical point of view, this kind of horrible, the idea of music being used as an instrument of war. In the 1740s, the British executed young boy bagpipers after the Battle of Culloden because the bagpipes were an instrument of war. Which is interesting that the Black and Tans, when they went over the top in the 1418 war, also went over the top to bagpipes. This was the, but this one is, I'm talking to a number of composers, how you can incorporate this and what's it going to do. The process had kind of begun earlier. Last December, some of you may remember a few months ago, Michael Clarke came in to talk about Edith Cavell piece. And this was a picture which I almost couldn't bring myself to take of the Bank of Earth at the Belgian Army shooting range where Cavell was executed in 1915 in Brussels, it's a cemetery now. It's one of those, you feel horrible taking the picture. I couldn't even bring myself to edit it anyway. I don't want to get away from it. But since then, the
the Cavill project has happened, Diane has been involved in it here, but what one of the dialogues that emerged was, I found I wanted to revisit that, because in terms of Dover, Cavill is important as well, because she's one of the three bodies which were brought back after, ceremonially brought back through Dover after the war. There's Cavill, obviously the unknown soldier. Another is this man called Fayette, who, if you go to Liverpool Street Station, there's a huge war memorial there, enormous, for the men of the Great Eastern Railway, about 1,200 of them who were killed in the First World War. On the bottom, there's this, have you seen this plaque at the bottom? Of a Dutch, British but Dutch based merchant seaman who rammed a U-boat with his boat and sank it in 1915 and was executed by the Germans as being a spy. So his body was brought back. And what's really interesting is, if you're as much of a nerd as I am, I discovered that the same wagon was used to bring those back from Dover to London. It was a brand new Mansell designed wagon. And the wagon exists still. So I started thinking, well, can we go and do something in it? This preserved on the Kent and West, the East Kent and Sussex Railway, that they looked after it. So one of the first things I did with somebody else's music was to play with the idea of transcription. Nigel Clark wrote this piece called The Scarlet Flower for flugelhorn and 13 strings, responding to that Cavill question, and partly emerging from our quite traumatic trip to go and see that. And what I've been fiddling around with is, well, I suddenly remember that in the 17th century, and the dialogue of the 17th century turned out to be very important for the whole of this project, there was a big tradition of writing unaccompanied violin pieces imitating the trumpet. Matthäus did it, Walther did it, Vitali did it. And of course, what happens in those pieces is that the violin gets to play the notes the trumpet can't, which is, I think, one of the reasons composers like to do it. Of course, it also had a link over to the ideas of the early chamber music, which often was bass instrument with, if you like, violin-shaped object and sackbuck or trumpets. The relationship between brass instruments and string instruments was very, very strong in chamber music terms until brass instruments got too loud. So these pieces written in the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century, respond to that. So I'm not going to play the whole of it, so I've been fiddling around with the trumpet or flugelhorn material, thinking what happens if you put this in the distance. And one of the things that's interesting is you'd be surprised at the number of legend composers who actually like the idea of people messing with the material, transcribing it. We tend not to think of transcribing contemporary music, but of course it's an interesting way into the process. It's also worked out very interestingly because Nigel himself is from Margate, he's from Kent, and he was an army, very much, he was in the army, so he's become very useful in this process of talking about this. So I'll just tell you the beginning of this. Things he and I have been talking about is the idea that you can play with the music, which is almost got no musical activity going on. That fanfares, trumpet, reveilles, and last posts are just the bare material of harmony, chords, very simple things, just playing around in fanfares. So that sort of found its way into the project. I'm just going to keep. I've said that the 17th century became important, and one of the reasons was to do with the idea of arrivals and departures. I was thinking about how do we define, what's the difference between war and peace? It's often over-iterated, the notion that the organising principle of any society is for war. That's what I'm not interested in. I am actually interested in the idea of the extension of politics by other means. And it struck me that what's interesting is that I was looking at types of travel, And particularly going through Dover, there seemed to be two types of travel. There was pilgrimage, and there was travel either during or at the end or beginning of wartime. And I found a really rather alarming kind of coincidence between the arrival of Charles II, when this is from Pepys's diary, when Pepys goes over the Shannon in England, very excited to pick up Charles II to come back after the fall of the Commonwealth. On the boat on the way over, it, Pepys and his friends are discussing which of them are going to be knighted. And they're very dismayed to find that none of them do. And then Pepys is even more disgusted to find he doesn't get put in the king's dinghy, but it's put in another one, and the king's spaniel pees on him. And then, as you can see, what's the line? It makes him think the king is no more than any other people because he has, he's peed on by the king's dog. But what's kind of interesting is the ritual that goes with it. And as you know, as performers, ritual is something which we are surrounded with and we take perhaps not enough notice of. You notice the thing that the king arrives and the mayor of the town comes, give him a white staff, the badge of his place, etc., and there's a canopy. And then I'm trying to jump to the place. Don't pretend you haven't seen this. It's in the wrong order. In December 1918, the very first American president to visit the UK disembarked at Dover. I don't know why I got it. This is Woodrow Wilson disembarking at Dover. He's taking some time. The peace conference is going to happen later at Versailles. He's come from Paris. And there's this description of him being escorted over the channel to midway in the middle of the channel by French ships and then by British ships on the other half, because as soon as the war was over, the idea that immediately the lines were redrawn. And he was met, this is coming through the southeastern Chatham Railway Terminal, which is still stands there by the cruise terminal now in Dover, and young girls dressed in white with American aprons, American flag aprons there, threw roses under the feet of Woodrow Wilson and the Duke of Cornwall, who was, of course, the king's uncle, as they walked in. And then they were met by the mayor with a white staff, and there was a formal exchange. It was almost word for word how Pepys had described it. The same thing happened. And so I started digging out other descriptions of, I need to just get back to where I was, of arrivals and departures from Dover. And of course, these then started to have a kind of colloquy with arrivals and departures of troops. Rupert Brooke is particularly interesting because he leaves Dover. He's one of the last troops to leave from Dover because eventually it's only either dignitaries or bodies coming in through Dover. One of the reasons being that the railway became unusable by large numbers because of a land split. And he describes this thing of just all these people cheering, and he thinks how many of them are going to be dead. And he comes up with this amazing word in the letter. He decides that life is merely a flash between two darknesses. It's this amazing letter. Another one I found from him is a poem that he wrote in 1909 describing being seasick on the ferry. And I think that's one of the things that fascinated me, was that because the English in particular have a cult of First World War poetry, it means we have a tendency to then cut that out and not look at anything around it. In France and Germany, where there is no equivalent cult, in fact, in France in particular, they resist the idea. They get very angry if you talk about it. It means there's less of a tendency to treat poets as war poets. A classic example would be Apollinaire, who died as a result of a wound at the end of the war. But, I've got into fights with French friends about this. I don't want to have him considered as a war poet. So that's another kind of equivalency. This was one I couldn't resist. This was on a ship about to leave Dover, and this was almost the same view drawn by another hero of mine from the 17th century, Wenceslas Hollar, who was a Czech-born artist who was brought by the Duke of Arundel to become the greatest topographical artist of London. And that whole, we're all, wherever we are, are immigrants, but I come from East London, I'm totally immigrant community, I've all grown up in that, I'm of Sephardic stroke, Huguenot mashup mess, and I love the idea that we can't get away from the arrivals and departures, we're all mixing things up, and the war made that more extreme, if you like, and and Holler's a hero of mine also because of the way he draws. So that started to be an influence. Another thing that started to pour its way in was the relationship to the natural world. It's really interesting when you start doing a project, doing, so in this case, walking, and you realise you've got to respond in some way. And I found myself being very excited about that I'd never seen so many yew trees. If you've walked the yew tree north down the way, particularly from Merston to Farnham, for instance, and Merston to Guildford or to Box Hill, you have these incredible forests of yew and juniper, which are just, and this incredible rock chalk roads. Of course, there is a martial relationship between the ancient yew trees in churchyards. This is a drawing I did in a churchyard almost at Alton, west of Farnham, on St Swithin's Way, where I haunted, kept going. And of course, the reason, there's two reasons. The yew trees, we all know, are in churchyards because to stop the sheep going and eating with the berry boys. But the real reason they're there is because of Richard to make longbows. You know, the evidence of Britain being always ready for war is around you the whole time, just as much as the nobles who started planting oak trees during the Napoleonic War have dances and songs written about them as being hugely patriotic gestures because they were providing for the navy, which would be built in 150 years' time, as if the navy in 150 years after the Napoleonic War was going to need oak.
So isn't there a legend that the yew trees actually, because of growing, they actually degrade the bones underground?
I've heard that about cypresses. I didn't know about that. Really?
You think yew trees?
Oh my goodness, I didn't know.
Other things, I think it's true, but I think it's a legend.
Yeah. Other things that spots you can't get away from are, you know, this postcard I found, which was taken a couple of years before the war broke out in the new park in Dover. It's just up near you look at it, and you look at these young people standing by the ponds, and you start thinking, what's going to happen to them? All around you, of course, there's the evidence of the iconoclasts. This is from a church in Snodland, and that's where a coloured rood screen had been sliced off by one of Edward VI's goons and miraculously kept its paint, which is kind of fantastic. One person who was a really big influence on the project is a wonderful writer about music, a poet and critic from Minnesota, a good friend of mine called Patricia Hampel, who wrote an extraordinary book. In fact, I want to get her in here at some point. An amazing book called Spillville, which is an account of going and spending time in the little town, little bohemian community in Iowa, where Dvorak wrote the string quintet and the American quartet. She just goes there and sees what happens. And I love that. Men are not very good at this. Men have a tendency to want to know why they're going somewhere, but I'm married to a Seven Sisters Bryn Mawr feminist, so if I don't say this, you'll kill me. What's amazing about the writing of someone like Hampel is the idea you go somewhere and you just wait. And one of the things she discovered, which nobody noticed before, was that there were recordings in the library at Spillville of old people recorded in the 1920s who remembered Dvorak employing them to knock the birds out of the trees so he can listen to them singing. You know, that kind of thing. It's just marvellous. So this book, Spillville, was very, very helpful. And she talks about the idea that putting your footsteps somewhere to try and get something from it is a kind of pilgrimage. This is the memorial. This was just 4 days ago, and I was so horrified by it, I had to take it. That's the War Memorial on Liverpool Street Station. That's the 1002. And of course, at the beginning of the First World War, there was... it wasn't that railway workers were told they had to enlist, but what was interesting was that even before conscription, railway workers got so angry with the fact that they were treated as not being useful to the war effort. They went on being badly paid, and they couldn't get the free food which was being handed out to everybody else, despite the fact that they were working for the war effort, that they enlisted in very, very large numbers, actually almost out of anger. So it was only the Second World War where it was recognised it needed to make sure that the railways could function. Of course, and it sounds very strange, and you get used to it, but when you start walking and you actually take notice of things like this wall down here, this is the one in the wonderful church of Y, which I mean, a town I'm completely enamored of now. And it was interesting seeing that at the same time as noticing things like this. This is a 12th century foundation stone in almost immaculate condition in this amazing church. Did you go to Apostling Church when you did the walk? No one's quite sure what date it refers to, but you start looking at inscriptions. What became more and more important was starting looking for roads. And one of the images you can't get away from when you're walking along the North Downs Way is of being pushed into a ditch. And then you start to recognise, because this gets written about by people at Ford Madox Ford and Parade's End, which of course is also partially about the southeast of England, became very important, because Madox Ford talks a lot about the fact that the primary job of a trench is as a path. He talks about all the different ways you can walk along the trench. He keeps insisting it's a path, and talking about, and then we all know the thing of seeing how a medieval road, just or ancient road, throws up detritus and builds banks on either side. That sounds very, very crude, but this idea of how do we look at ancient pathways, and this is one that we found was a very low tide off the beach at the Culver, west of Margate the other day, and we found this road cut into a rock there.
It's
not just the North Downs Way, but even like if you look at things like the Ridgeway. What's amazing when you get a road which has been constantly used is when you think it's old enough, you then realise it's much older. These ancient roads in the southeast of England are so old that they map the time when most anything which was just above sea level now was underwater. So if you look at the UK geologically, let's look at the southeast of it. There's this wonderful thing where you get coming in from the west, like a trident. These lines of chalk which come in from Salisbury Plain. One goes along the South Downs, the coast there. One's the North Downs there, and there's the Thames Estuary, and the other one goes up to the Chilterns like this. And all of them have these incredibly ancient hill pathways. When the Romans arrived, they weren't very interested in hills, so they were much more interested in making roads in valleys and draining valleys. And there's considerable evidence, and this is kind of interesting in terms of how you make counterpoints of ideas, that a lot of societies where the Romans came and invaded, because most of the Roman Empire didn't realise it was part of the Roman Empire, I would like to point that out, but no idea. But particularly in a place like Thanet, or even say around the north-eastern Chilterns, it's pretty sure that you have these different levels of society who, apart from just crossing valleys, would never have had any contact with each other. This was one of the few remaining First World War it's an explosive casement on the north side of Dover. And I remember first seeing that in Asterix in Britain, the idea of a civilization where a tree was taken hold of it, the idea that it all gets destroyed within 100 years by a tree growing into it. And so that was very, very beautiful and rather hopeful, actually, for us. This was something I ran into a couple of days ago, which moved me beyond measure. This is a picture, it seems to have been taken in 1915, it's in the Imperial War Museum archive, and I assure you that's the Pictorial Archive of Imperial War Museum online is one of the great wonders. It's absolutely extraordinary. And this is a Canadian soldier and a German soldier wounded sharing or lighting a cigarette together. And makes a nonsense of the whole thing, really, doesn't it? And one of the things I was reading was, it's going to come out later, was Fritz Kreisler's little account called 4 Weeks in the Trenches, where he actually very touchingly writes about the bizarre thing that happens when he found that he became, at the same moment he became inured to death of someone next to him and inured to killing, and this was the same moment that you realised that you bore no ill will to the person in the trench opposite. That there was a bizarre coincidence there. He described that once the whole thing had become so cauterised in some ways, they would have these friendly conversations with people while they were shooting at them. And Chrysler was persuaded to write about this, much against his will. And it's very, very sensitive. If you just write